This is KDNK from Carbondale, Colorado. Garfield County zoning has been adjusted to allow for the installation of tiny homes, KDNK's Raleigh Burley reports.
Garfield County Commissioners recently amended the Land Use and Development Code, Article 15, to strike a 20 by 20 square foot minimum requirement for dwelling units.
We approve a Land Use and Development Code text amendment, including but not limited to Article 15 regarding the definition of a dwelling unit as it relate as a, of a dwelling unit, and that we on Article 15 we strike at least 20 feet wide and 20 feet long, and then it would read a single unit dwelling that meets the building code.
The commissioners then approved minor adjustments to the building code adopted this past year to conform with the change to the Land Use and Development Code.
In the building code, we also had the 20-foot by 20-foot requirement. So now that it's not in the zoning code, it obviously doesn't make sense to keep it in the building code. So what staff proposes is to pull out that 20 by 20 requirement.
In addition, the county commissioners approved the adoption of Appendix V.
All these units have some sort of a loft, and getting up to the loft doesn't really, trying to put a staircase in isn't a good way to do it. So in the wisdom of the ICC, International Code Council, and actually people submitting information to them, they came up with an Appendix V that'll be in the 2018 codes, which actually takes the codes from RVs, recreational vehicles, what's worked there, and applies them to these tiny homes. So now you can have a sleeping loft that has a lower headspace. You can put in a staircase or a ladder or alternating treads. There's a couple of ways to do it. And once you're up in the sleeping loft, there's actually an emergency skylight, so you can get the heck out of there should there be a fire on the first floor.
Regarding these changes, David Peshnichak of the County Planning Division acknowledged.
On the staff side, we don't view this as necessarily being a solution to the affordable housing problem, but to add to the toolkit of housing options available to people.
These changes to the codes allowing for tiny houses in Garfield County become effective as of this month. For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
The U.S. Forest Service announced Monday that it is partnering with Rudai Water and Power and Colorado Parks and Wildlife to install gates at the boat ramp at Rudai Reservoir to help prevent aquatic nuisance species like zebra mussels from invading the lake. Starting this week, the ramp will be closed to motor vehicles and trailered boats until the mandatory boat inspection program starts in May. More information is at the Aspen Soperus Ranger District or at the Colorado Parks and Wildlife website. The race to succeed Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper in 2018 is already underway. Some big names have recently announced their campaigns, the moves that could impact one of the most significant agenda items still facing lawmakers, transportation funding. Penta Berkland spoke to State House reporters about the race.
Joining us, we have Ed Sealover, a reporter for the Denver Business Journal, and Peter Marcus with ColoradoPolitics.com. A lot going on here under the Gold Dome and a lot going on outside of the Gold Dome related to the governor's race, which will be here before we know it and will have a lot of impact on what happens here at the state legislature. Peter, I know you've been covering it. Seems like it could be a pretty crowded field on both sides.
All of the rumored candidates who everybody had been talking about for months, if not a year or more, are starting to come out of the woodwork and actually announce. Biggest announcements is George Brockler on the Republican side, the Arapahoe County District Attorney, who was the lead prosecutor in the James Holmes Aurora shooter case. He just announced that really was the first big Republican name in. And then we have Ed Perlmutter on the Democratic side, United States Representative in the 7th. He's jumping into the race. And then Kerry Kennedy, former state treasurer, is also going to jump in on the Democratic side. So yeah, we're starting to see this come to life a little bit. It should be a very interesting, tight, contested races to watch.
Do you think we'll see a lot more announcements?
I think that this is going to be a big dump for right now, and then it's probably going to calm down for a little bit. I hear another rumored candidate, Republican Walker Stapleton, the current state treasurer, is going to wait a while before he makes any decision. So I think that things will calm down for a little bit. We just have a lot to digest right now.
And Ed, Governor Hickenlooper will have one more legislative session after this session. how much do Republicans want to pick up that seat?
I think Republicans are salivating at the opportunity. They had a couple of missed opportunities in recent years. In 2010, they nominated Dan Mays, possibly the worst candidate the Republicans have ever put up. In 2014, they lost a close one with Bob Beaupre. Hickenlooper was able very successfully to generate support from business owners, who are crucial to Republicans winning most statewide elections, and moderates. I don't think you're going to see as much support for some of these Democratic candidates. Now, had Ken Salazar, the former U.S. Senator and Interior Secretary, jumped in, I think he could have put together the same coalition Hickenlooper could have. Perlmutter, Kennedy, Senator Mike Johnston, who is in the race already as well, are not going to be able to draw from that same base. They all have records that are going to be attacked as being more liberals than Hickenlooper was. And frankly, don't forget, they did attack Hickenlooper as a liberal, even if many people still do consider him a moderate. And they see this as an opportunity, especially with a candidate like Brock Lehr-Stapleton, who has some statewide name recognition, to steal the seat.
What are some of the early themes we may be seeing, and how much of it will be a reaction to what's happening nationally, or do you think it'll be more focused on state issues?
Well, I have two words: unaffiliated voters. They're going to be participating in the primary after voters just allowed that to happen this past November. So the messaging you're seeing from these candidates is not necessarily pandering all the way to the left or all the way to the right, because usually what happens is like the activist base shows up for the primaries. That's not going to really be the case anymore. So you're starting to see them talk about issues that really affect people's lives. School, education is a major theme that keeps coming up. Taxpayer, fiscal responsibility keeps coming up. So, you know, you're going to see these candidates have to reach out from outside their usual bases to try to attract a much wider berth of audience.
In the case of Republican George Brockler, I know he's been pretty vocal opposing a proposed sales tax increase for transportation. Lawmakers are discussing that this session and would send it to voters. So some of them are weighing on stuff that's happening here this session.
I would argue that assuming that the transportation tax hike can even get through the legislature to the voters in November, that'll almost be a kind of a proxy start of this race. You're going to see Democratic candidates come out for the tax hike, and then you see Republican candidates come out against it, and that vote will tell us a little bit about the mood the voters are in. This is not the normal start of the election cycle. It's usually a little later than this, but I think things are pushing it up, and I think this transportation issue is one of the main reasons we're seeing that acceleration.
Thanks. Ed Seelever with the Denver Business Journal, Peter Marcus with ColoradoPolitics.com. I'm Benta Berkland, and this is Capital Conversation.
And Colorado gubernatorial candidate Mike Johnston made a whistle stop in Carbondale last week. This clip features two questions from a Q&A with the audience.
I'm just curious, from your perspective, what kind of concrete actions you would work towards to implement right here in Colorado to slow down climate change?
Right. So I believe in collaboration. I also don't believe in compromising core values. So I don't believe in waiving methane gas capture rules at the federal level that allow you to flare methane gas in the environment and not capture it. That's why we passed legislation here to do it. If Trump repeals it at the federal level, we got to protect it here. So as you know, I think there's a lot of things we're going to have to play defense on the environmental front over the next 2 to 4 years. And these are places where the governor's race is the most important bulwark against that, because whether it's methane rules or river and stream protections or public lands that get released from federal control to state control, that's all going to be in the governor's capacity to protect. So I think there's some really important things to play on defense. On offense, on the things to protect climate change are, I think we need to move dramatically towards a broader portfolio of renewable energy. So I supported the mandated increase to 30% of our energy now coming from wind and solar. I think that can be expanded significantly. I think, because you sound like an energy policy wonk, I also think there's really important work to do on what we call decoupling the utility grid, which is right now your utility company works on a simple system, which is the more electricity you use, the more money they make, which means it's in their benefit to have you use as much electricity as possible. There is a way that some states have tried to reverse that, which is you make it in the best interest of the utility company to make more money when you use less electricity. And so what they're doing is, instead of trying to encourage you to keep the lights on when you're asleep at night, they're trying to constantly push you to cut your energy use. And so I think that is a really important step that we could do. I also think there's significant expansion of, one of the biggest impacts on climate change are vehicles. And so the more that we can do to move towards electric vehicles and electric fleet vehicles is really important. I sponsored legislation last year to expand and simplify the electric vehicle tax credit. So it's now a one-time point of sale $5,000 credit you can assign right there, and you don't have to file any papers. Or it's not like the phone version where like they try to give you the credit, but you have to send 17 pieces of paper back at 14-day increments over 2.5 years, and you never get it. So I think those are the big three I would think about: are expanding the renewable portfolio, the grid changes and the decoupling, and also expansion of renewable modes of travel.
My mom lives in Longmont, and I was quite applauding when Longmont was saying, no, you can't frack in the borders of the city. Mm-hmm. And then the state said, oh, no, Longmont, you can't do that. In this valley, we just fought a big fight over Thompson Divide. And part of that for us is, of course, that's our watershed.
Yeah.
Fracking fluid goes into our water table and into what we drink. And we're not with the guy on TV who drank the fracking fluid. I'm not going there. So I'm really upset about the state overruling cities that want to control the quality of what goes on in their borders. So talk to me about local control and fracking.
The one upside to note of natural gas, as you know, is when we look at climate change, one of the reasons we've been able to move away from coal, you know, we've voted to close down many of the coal plants in Colorado is because natural gas is a better, what we call bridge fuel, to expand wind and solar. And so for people that aren't energy junkies, if you want to have wind or solar on your grid, it's fantastic. The challenge is if the sun goes down and you have a solar energy supply, what is your backup supply? And used to be that was coal, which was very dirty and hard to turn on and off. The benefit of gas is you can turn it on and off as quickly as the sun goes on or off. And so it's a much better partner fuel. So that's why I think natural gas expansion has been important in some ways to support renewable energies. I'd like to see it be much more aggressive expansion of renewables. That's the good side. The downside is what you've described. And so I think there should be real limits to where and how we drill and frack. And I think there are three examples. One is you shouldn't obviously drill in places that are environmentally sensitive, like the Thompson Divide is the classic example of where we shouldn't be drilling. I think the second is we also shouldn't be drilling in places that are geologically unstable. So if you look at, I just looked today at an earthquake map of Oklahoma, which is astonishing because they're drilling into layers of sandstone that are highly unstable and you get earthquakes. So I think you don't want to drill in those places. And I think the third is you have to figure out in the Broomfields and in the other metro areas, you know, how you have, what separation you have from residential settlements, you know, residential developments. And right now there's been a big battle about how far the setbacks are. I think there is the pushback has been the Supreme Court has said you need to have one statewide set of regulations, which is the current law. I think that still gives us a chance with the Oil and Gas Commission to look at renegotiating what should the terms of those setbacks be and should you take into account how close they are to residential developments. Because I think that's, I would say, environmental protections, sort of geological safety, and human contact ought to be the three areas to push more aggressively on resettling that. Thank you for the question.
You can find the entire Mike Johnston talk plus Q&A at kdnk.org. A little sunshine on the tops of the western peaks at this hour. The big old full moon has gone down, and we expect another beautiful day. Carbondale's high today, 65 degrees. Good morning.